Are you pissing?
Or something of the sort. I would freeze, or, the contrary, pursue my activity, pretending not to have heard. The sound would disappear, but the hurt would linger, like the smell of piss long after it has evaporated. Teachers started doing it too. It was the heat. As the day wore on, the geography lesson, which in the morning had been as compact as an oasis, started to stretch out like the Thar desert. The history lesson, so alive when the day was young, became parched and dusty. The mathematics lesson, so precise at first, became muddled. In their afternoon fatigue, as they wiped their foreheads and the backs of their necks with their handkerchiefs, without meaning to offend or get a laugh, even teachers forgot the fresh aquatic promise of my name and distorted it in a shameful way. By nearly imperceptible modulations, I could hear the change. It was as if their tongues were charioteers driving wild horses. They could manage well enough the first syllable, the P, but eventually the heat was too much, and they lost control of their frothy-mouthed steeds and could no longer rein them in for the climb to the second syllable, the scene. Instead, they plunged hell-bent into sing, and next time around, all was lost. My hand would be up to give an answer, and I would be acknowledged with a, "Yes, pissing." Often the teacher wouldn't realize what he had just called me. He would look at me wearily after a moment, wondering why I wasn't coming out with the answer. And sometimes the class, as beaten down by the heat as he was, wouldn't react either. Not a snicker or a smile. But I always heard the slur. I spent my last year at St. Joseph's School feeling like the persecuted Prophet Muhammad in Mecca, peace be upon him. But just as he planned his flight to Medina, the Hejira that would mark the beginning of Muslim time, I planned my escape and the beginning of a new time for me. After St. Joseph's, I went to Petit Seminaire, the best private English medium secondary school in Pondicherry. Ravi was already there, and like all younger brothers, I would suffer from following in the footsteps of a popular older sibling. He was the athlete of his generation at Petit Seminaire, a fearsome bowler and a powerful batter, the captain of the town's best cricket team, our very own Kapil Dev. That I was a swimmer made no waves. It seems to be a law of human nature that those who live by the sea are suspicious of swimmers, just as those who live in the mountains are suspicious of mountain climbers. But following in someone's shadow wasn't my escape, though I would have taken any name over pissing, even Ravi's brother. I had a better plan than that. I put it to execution on the very first day of school, in the very first class. Around me were other alumni of St. Joseph's. The class started the way all new classes start, with the stating of names. We called them out from our desks in the order in which we happened to be sitting.
Ganapati Kumar,
said Ganapati Kumar.
Vipin Nath,
said Vipin Nath.
Shamshul Huda,
said Shamshul Huda.
Peter Dharmaraj,
said Peter Dharmaraj. Each name elicited a tick on a list and a brief mnemonic stare from the teacher. I was terribly nervous.
Ajit Gyadson,
said Ajit Gyadson, four desks away.
Sampath Saroja,
said Sampath Saroja, three away.
Stanley Kumar,
said Stanley Kumar, two away.
Sylvester Naveen,
said Sylvester Naveen, right in front of me. It was my turn. Time to put down Satan. Medina, here I come. I got up from my desk and hurried to the blackboard. Before the teacher could say a word, I picked up a piece of chalk and said as I wrote,
"My name is Pisin Molitor Patel, known to all as..."
I double-underlined the first two letters of my given name.
Pai Patel.
For good measure, I added,
pi equals 3.14.
And I drew a large circle, which I then sliced in two with a diameter to evoke that basic lesson of geometry. There was silence. The teacher was staring at the board. I was holding my breath. Then he said,
"Very well, Pi, sit down. Next time you will ask permission before leaving your desk." "Yes, sir."
He ticked my name off and looked at the next boy.
"Mansoor Ahmad,"
said Mansoor Ahmad. I was saved.
"Gautam Selvaraj,"
said Gautam Selvaraj. I could breathe.
"Arun Annaji,"
said Arun Annaji. A new beginning. I repeated the stunt with every teacher. Repetition is important in the training not only of animals, but also of humans. Between one commonly named boy and the next, I rushed forward and emblazoned, sometimes with a terrible screech, the details of my rebirth. It got to be that, after a few times, the boys sang along with me. A crescendo that climaxed after a quick intake of air while I underlined the proper note with such a rousing rendition of my new name that it would have been the delight of any choir master. A few boys followed up with a whispered, urgent 3.14 as I wrote as fast as I could, and I ended the concert by slicing the circle with such vigor that bits of chalk went flying. When I put my hand up that day, which I did every chance I had, teachers granted me the right to speak with a single syllable that was music to my ears. Students followed suit. Even the St. Joseph's Devils. In fact, the name caught on. Truly we are a nation of aspiring engineers. Shortly after, there was a boy named Om Prakash who was calling himself Omega, and another who was passing himself off as Upsilon, and for a while there was a Gamma, a Lambda, and a Delta. But I was the first and the most enduring of the Greeks at Petit Seminaire. Even my brother, the captain of the cricket team, that local god, approved. He took me aside the next week. "What's this I hear about a nickname you have?" he said. I kept silent. Because whatever mocking was to come, it was to come. There was no avoiding it. "I didn't realize you liked the color yellow so much."
"The color yellow?"
I looked around. No one must hear what he was about to say, especially not one of his lackeys.
"Ravi, what do you mean?"
I whispered. "It's all right with me, brother. Anything's better than pissing. Even lemon pie." As he sauntered away, he smiled and said,
"You look a bit red in the face."
But he held his peace. And so, in that Greek letter that looks like a shack with a corrugated tin roof, in that elusive, irrational number with which scientists try to understand the universe, I found refuge. Chapter 6. He's an excellent cook. His overheated house is always smelling of something delicious. His spice rack looks like an apothecary's shop. When he opens his refrigerator or his cupboards, there are many brand names I don't recognize. In fact, I can't even tell what language they're in. We are in India. But he handles Western dishes equally well. He makes me the most zesty yet subtle macaroni and cheese I've ever had. And his vegetarian tacos would be the envy of all Mexico. I noticed something else. His cupboards are jam-packed. Behind every door, on every shelf, stand mountains of neatly stacked cans and packages. A reserve of food to last the siege of Leningrad. Chapter 7. It was my luck to have a few good teachers in my youth, men and women who came into my dark head and lit a match. One of these was Mr. Satish Kumar, my biology teacher at Petit Seminaire, and an active communist who was always hoping Tamil Nadu would stop electing movie stars and go the way of Kerala. He had a most peculiar appearance. The top of his head was bald and pointy, yet he had the most impressive jowls I have ever seen, and his narrow shoulders gave way to a massive stomach that looked like the base of a mountain, except that the mountain stood in thin air, for it stopped abruptly and disappeared horizontally into his pants. It's a mystery to me how his stick-like legs supported the weight above them, but they did, though they moved in surprising ways at times, as if his knees could bend in any direction. His construction was geometric. He looked like two triangles, a small one and a larger one, balanced on two parallel lines. But organic, quite warty actually, and with sprigs of black hair sticking out of his ears. And friendly. His smile seemed to take up the whole base of his triangular head. Mr. Kumar was the first avowed atheist I ever met. I discovered this not in the classroom, but at the zoo. He was a regular visitor who read the labels and descriptive notices in their entirety and approved of every animal he saw. Each, to him, was a triumph of logic and mechanics, and nature as a whole was an exceptionally fine illustration of science. To his ears, when an animal felt the urge to mate, it said Gregor Mendel, recalling the father of genetics, and when it was time to show its mettle, Charles Darwin, the father of natural selection, and what we took to be bleating, grunting, hissing, snorting, roaring, growling, howling, chirping, and screeching were but the thick accents of foreigners. When Mr. Kumar visited the zoo, it was to take the pulse of the universe, and his stethoscopic mind always confirmed to him that everything was in order, that everything was order. He left the zoo feeling scientifically refreshed. The first time I saw his triangular form teetering and tottering about the zoo, I was shy to approach him. As much as I liked him as a teacher, he was a figure of authority, and I, a subject. I was a little afraid of him. I observed him at a distance. He had come to the rhinoceros pit. The two Indian rhinos were great attractions at the zoo because of the goats. Rhinos are social animals, and when we got Peek, a young wild male, he was showing signs of suffering from isolation, and he was eating less and less. As a stopgap measure, while he searched for a female, Father thought of seeing if Peek couldn't be accustomed to living with goats. If it worked, it would save a valuable animal. If it didn't, it would only cost a few goats. It worked marvelously. Peek and the herd of goats became inseparable, even when Summit arrived. Now, when the rhinos bathed, the goats stood around the muddy pool, and when the goats ate in their corner, Peek and Summit stood next to them like guards. The living arrangement was very popular with the public. Mr. Kumar looked up and saw me. He smiled and, one hand holding on to the railing, the other waving, signaled me to come over.
"Hello, Pai," he said.
"Hello, sir. It's good of you to come to the zoo."
"I come here all the time. One might say it's my temple."
"This is interesting."
He was indicating the pit.
"If we had politicians like these goats and rhinos, we'd have fewer problems in our country. Unfortunately, we have a prime minister who has the armor plating of a rhinoceros without any of his good sense."
I didn't know much about politics. Father and mother complained regularly about Mrs. Gandhi, but it meant little to me. She lived far away in the north, not at the zoo and not in Pondicherry. But I felt I had to say something.
"Religion will save us,"
I said. Since when I could remember, religion had been very close to my heart.
Religion?
Mr. Kumar grinned broadly.
I don't believe in religion. Religion is darkness.
Darkness? I was puzzled. I thought, darkness is the last thing that religion is. Religion is light. Was he testing me? Was he saying religion is darkness, the way he sometimes said in class things like,
mammals lay eggs,
to see if someone would correct him?
Only platypuses, sir.
There are no grounds for going beyond a scientific explanation of reality, and no sound reason for believing anything but our sense experience. A clear intellect, close attention to detail, and a little scientific knowledge will expose religion as superstitious bosh. God does not exist. Did he say that? Or am I remembering the lines of later atheists? At any rate, it was something of the sort. I had never heard such words.
Why tolerate darkness? Everything is here and clear, if only we look carefully.
He was pointing at Peak. Now, though I had great admiration for Peak, I had never thought of a rhinoceros as a light bulb. He spoke again.
Some people say God died during the partition in 1947. He may have died in 1971 during the war. Or he may have died yesterday here in Pondicherry in an orphanage. That's what some people say, Pai. When I was your age, I lived in bed, racked with polio. I asked myself every day, where is God? Where is God? Where is God? God never came. It wasn't God who saved me. It was medicine. Reason is my prophet, and it tells me that as a watch stops, so we die. It's the end. If the watch doesn't work properly, it must be fixed here and now by us. One day we will take hold of the means of production, and there will be justice on earth.
This was all a bit much for me. The tone was right, loving and brave, but the details seemed bleak. I said nothing. It wasn't for fear of angering Mr. Kumar. I was more afraid that in a few words thrown out he might destroy something that I loved. What if his words had the effect of polio on me? What a terrible disease that must be if it could kill God in a man. He walked off, pitching and rolling in the wild sea that was the steady ground.
Don't forget the test on Tuesday. Study hard, 3.14.
Yes, Mr. Kumar.
He became my favorite teacher at Petit Seminaire, and the reason I studied zoology at the University of Toronto. I felt a kinship with him. It was my first clue that atheists are my brothers and sisters of a different faith, and every word they speak speaks of faith. Like me, they go as far as the legs of reason will carry them, and then they leap. I'll be honest about it. It is not atheists who get stuck in my craw, but agnostics. Doubt is useful for a while. We must all pass through the Garden of Gethsemane. If Christ played with doubt, so must we. If Christ spent an anguished night in prayer, if he burst out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then surely we are also permitted doubt. But we must move on. To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. Chapter 8. We commonly say in the trade that the most dangerous animal in a zoo is man. In a general way, we mean how our species' excessive predatoriness has made the entire planet our prey. More specifically, we have in mind the people who feed fish hooks to the otters, razors to the bears, apples with small nails in them to the elephants, and hardware variations on the theme. Ballpoint pens, paper clips, safety pins, rubber bands, combs, coffee spoons, horseshoes, pieces of broken glass, rings, brooches, and other jewelry. And not just cheap plastic bangles, gold wedding bands too. Drinking straws, plastic cutlery, ping pong balls, tennis balls, and so on. The obituary of zoo animals that have died from being fed foreign bodies would include gorillas, bison, storks, rheas, ostriches, seals, sea lions, big cats, bears, camels, elephants, monkeys, and most every variety of deer, ruminant, and songbird. Among zookeepers, Goliath's death is famous. He was a bull elephant seal, a great big venerable beast of 2 tons, star of his European zoo, loved by all visitors. He died of internal bleeding after someone fed him a broken beer bottle. The cruelty is often more active and direct. The literature contains reports on the many torments inflicted upon zoo animals. A shoebill dying of shock after having its beak smashed with a hammer. A moose stag losing its beard along with a strip of flesh the size of an index finger to a visitor's knife. This same moose was poisoned 6 months later. A monkey's arm broken after reaching out for proffered nuts. A deer's antlers attacked with a hacksaw. A zebra stabbed with a sword. And other assaults on other animals with walking sticks, umbrellas, hairpins, knitting needles, scissors, and whatnot, often with an aim to taking an eye out or to injuring sexual parts. Animals are also poisoned. And there are indecencies even more bizarre. Onanists breaking a sweat on monkeys, ponies, birds. A religious freak who cut a snake's head off. A deranged man who took to urinating in an elk's mouth. At Pondicherry, we were relatively fortunate. We were spared the sadists who plied European and American zoos. Nonetheless, our golden agouti vanished. Stolen by someone who ate it, Father suspected. Various birds, pheasants, peacocks, macaws, lost feathers to people greedy for their beauty. We caught a man with a knife climbing into the pen for mouse deer. He said he was going to punish evil Ravana, who in the Ramayana took the form of a deer when he kidnapped Sita, Rama's consort. Another man was nabbed in the process of stealing a cobra. He was a snake charmer whose own snake had died. Both were saved. The cobra from a life of servitude and bad music, and the man from a possible death bite. We had to deal on occasion with stone throwers who found the animals too placid and wanted a reaction. And we had the lady whose sari was caught by a lion. She spun like a yo-yo, choosing mortal embarrassment over mortal end. The thing was, it wasn't even an accident. She had leaned over, thrust her hand in the cage, and waved the end of her sari in the lion's face with what intent we never figured out. She was not injured. There were many fascinated men who came to her assistance. Her flustered explanation to Father was,
"Who ever heard of a lion eating a cotton sari? I thought lions were carnivores."
Our worst troublemakers were the visitors who gave food to the animals. Despite our vigilance, Dr. Atal, the zoo veterinarian, could tell by the number of animals with digestive disturbances which had been the busy days at the zoo. He called tidbititis the cases of enteritis or gastritis due to too many carbohydrates, especially sugar. Sometimes we wished people had stuck to sweets. People have a notion that animals can eat anything without the least consequence to their health. Not so. One of our sloth bears became seriously ill with severe hemorrhagic enteritis after being given fish that had gone putrid by a man who was convinced he was doing a good deed. Just beyond the ticket booth, Father had painted on a wall in bright red letters the question, "Do you know which is the most dangerous animal in the zoo?" An arrow pointed to a small curtain. There were so many eager, curious hands that pulled at the curtain that we had to replace it regularly. Behind it was a mirror. But I learned at my expense that Father believed there was another animal even more dangerous than us, and one that was extremely common too, found on every continent, in every habitat. The redoubtable species Animalis anthropomorphicus. The animal as seen through human eyes. We've all met one, perhaps even owned one. It is an animal that is cute, friendly, loving, devoted, merry, understanding. These animals lie in ambush in every toy store and children's zoo. Countless stories are told of them. They are the pendants of those vicious, bloodthirsty, depraved animals that inflame the ire of the maniacs I've just mentioned, who vent their spite on them with walking sticks and umbrellas. In both cases, we look at an animal and see a mirror. The obsession with putting ourselves at the center of everything is the bane not only of theologians, but also of zoologists. I learned the lesson that an animal is an animal, essentially and practically removed from us twice. Once with Father, and once with Richard Barker. It was on a Sunday morning. I was quietly playing on my own. Father called out,
"Children, come here."
Something was wrong. His tone of voice set off a small alarm bell in my head. I quickly reviewed my conscience. It was clear. Ravi must be in trouble again. I wondered what he had done this time. I walked into the living room. Mother was there. That was unusual. The disciplining of children, like the tending of animals, was generally left to Father. Ravi walked in last, guilt written all over his criminal face.
"Ravi, be seen. I have a very important lesson for you today."
"Oh, really? Is this necessary?"
interrupted Mother. Her face was flushed. I swallowed. If Mother, normally so unruffled, so calm, was worried, even upset, it meant we were in serious trouble. I exchanged glances with Ravi.
"Yes, it is," said Father, annoyed. "It may very well save their lives."
Save our lives? It was no longer a small alarm bell that was ringing in my head.
They were big bells now, like the ones we heard from Sacred Heart of Jesus Church, not far from the zoo.
"But Piscine, he's only 8,
Mother insisted.
"He's the one who worries me the most."
"I'm innocent,"
I burst out.
"It's Ravi's fault, whatever it is. He did it."
"What?"
said Ravi.
"I haven't done anything wrong."
He gave me the evil eye.
"Shush,"
said Father, raising his hand. He was looking at Mother.
"Geeta, you've seen Piscine. He's at that age when boys run around and poke their noses everywhere."
"Me? A runarounder? An everywhere nose poker? Not so, not so."
"Defend me, Mother, defend me," I implored in my heart.
But she only sighed and nodded. A signal that the terrible business could proceed.
"Come with me," said Father.
We set out like prisoners off to their execution. We left the house, went through the gate, entered the zoo. It was early, and the zoo hadn't opened yet to the public. Animal keepers and groundskeepers were going about their work. I noticed Sitaram, who oversaw the orangutans, my favorite keeper. He paused to watch us go by. We passed birds, bears, apes, monkeys, ungulates, the terrarium house, the rhinos, the elephants, the giraffes. We came to the big cats, our tigers, lions, and leopards. Babu, their keeper, was waiting for us. We went round and down the path, and he unlocked the door to the cat house, which was at the center of a moated island. We entered. It was a vast and dim cement cavern, circular in shape, warm and humid, and smelling of cat urine. All around were great big cages divided up by thick green iron bars. A yellowish light filtered down from the skylights. Through the cage exits, we could see the vegetation of the surrounding island flooded with sunlight. The cages were empty, save one. Mahisha, our Bengal tiger patriarch, a lanky, hulking beast of 550 pounds, had been detained. As soon as we stepped in, he loped up to the bars of his cage and set off a full-throated snarl, ears flat against his skull and round eyes fixed on Babu. The sound was so loud and fierce, it seemed to shake the whole cat house. My knees started quaking. I got close to Mother. She was trembling too. Even Father seemed to pause and steady himself. Only Babu was indifferent to the outburst and to the searing stare that bored into him like a drill. He had a tested trust in iron bars. Mahisha started pacing to and fro against the limits of his cage. Father turned to us. "What animal is this?" he bellowed above Mahisha snarling.
"It's a tiger,"
Ravi and I answered in unison, obediently pointing out the blindingly obvious. "Are tigers dangerous?"
"Yes, Father. Tigers are dangerous."
"Tigers are very dangerous," Father shouted. "I want you to understand that you are never, under any circumstances, to touch a tiger, to pet a tiger, to put your hands through the bars of a cage, even to get close to a cage. Is that clear? Ravi?"
Ravi nodded vigorously.
"Piseen?"
I nodded even more vigorously. He kept his eyes on me. I nodded so hard I'm surprised my neck didn't snap and my head fall to the floor. I would like to say, in my own defense, that though I may have anthropomorphized the animals till they spoke fluent English, the pheasants complaining in uppity British accents of their tea being cold, and the baboons planning their bank robbery getaway in the flat, menacing tones of American gangsters, the fancy was always conscious. I quite deliberately dressed wild animals in tame costumes of my imagination, but I never deluded myself as to the real nature of my playmates. My poking nose had more sense than that. I don't know where Father got the idea that his youngest son was itching to step into a cage with a ferocious carnivore. But wherever the strange worry came from, and Father was a worrier, he was clearly determined to rid himself of it that very morning.
"I'm going to show you how dangerous tigers are," he continued. "I want you to remember this lesson for the rest of your lives."
He turned to Babu and nodded. Babu left. Mahisha's eyes followed him and did not move from the door he disappeared through. He returned a few seconds later, carrying a goat with its legs tied. Mother gripped me from behind. Mahisha's snarl turned into a growl deep in the throat. Babu unlocked, opened, entered, closed, and locked a cage next to the tiger's cage. Bars and a trap door separated the two. Immediately, Mahisha was up against the dividing bars, pawing them. To his growling, he now added explosive, arrested woofs. Babu placed the goat on the floor. Its flanks were heaving violently, its tongue hung from its mouth, and its eyes were spinning orbs. He untied its legs. The goat got to its feet. Babu exited the cage in the same careful way he had entered it. The cage had two floors, one level with us, the other at the back, higher by about 3 feet, that led outside to the island. The goat scrambled to this second level. Mahisha, now unconcerned with Babu, paralleled the move in his cage in a fluid, effortless motion. He crouched and lay still, his slowly moving tail the only sign of tension. Babu stepped up to the trap door between the cages and started pulling it open. In anticipation of satisfaction, Mahisha fell silent. I heard two things at that moment. Father saying, "Never forget this lesson," as he looked on grimly, and the bleating of the goat. It must have been bleating all along, only we couldn't hear it before. I could feel Mother's hand pressed against my pounding heart. The trapdoor resisted with sharp cries. Mahisha was beside himself. He looked as if he were about to burst through the bars. He seemed to hesitate between staying where he was, at the place where his prey was closest but most certainly out of reach, and moving to the ground level, further away, but where the trapdoor was located. He raised himself and started snarling again. The goat started to jump. It jumped to amazing heights. I had no idea a goat could jump so high. But the back of the cage was a high and smooth cement wall. With sudden ease, the trapdoor slid open. Silence fell again, except for bleating and the click-click of the goat's hooves against the floor. A streak of black and orange flowed from one cage to the next. Normally the big cats were not given food one day a week to simulate conditions in the wild. We found out later that Father had ordered that Mahisha not be fed for 3 days. I don't know if I saw blood before turning into Mother's arms, or if I daubed it on later in my memory with a big brush. But I heard. It was enough to scare the living vegetarian daylights out of me. Mother bundled us out. We were in hysterics. She was incensed.
How could you, Santosh? They're children. They'll be scarred for the rest of their lives.
Her voice was hot and tremulous. I could see she had tears in her eyes. I felt better. Gita, my bird, it's for their sake. What if Piseen had stuck his hand through the bars of the cage one day to touch the pretty orange fur? Better a goat than him, no? His voice was soft, nearly a whisper. He looked contrite. He never called her my bird in front of us. We were huddled around her. He joined us. But the lesson was not over, though it was gentler after that. Father led us to the lions and leopards. Once there was a madman in Australia who was a black belt in karate. He wanted to prove himself against the lions. He lost. Badly. The keepers found only half his body in the morning.
Yes, Father.
The Himalayan bears and the sloth bears.
One strike of the claws from these cuddly creatures, and your innards will be scooped out and splattered all over the ground.
Yes, Father.
The hippos.
With those soft, flabby mouths of theirs, they'll crush your body to a bloody pulp. On land, they can outrun you.
Yes, Father.
The hyenas.
The strongest jaws in nature. Don't think they're cowardly or that they only eat carrion. They're not, and they don't. They'll start eating you while you're still alive.
Yes, Father.
The orangutans.
As strong as 10 men. They'll break your bones as if they were twigs. I know some of them were once pets, and you played with them when they were small. But now they're grown up and wild and unpredictable.
Yes, Father.
The ostrich.
Looks flustered and silly, doesn't it? Listen up. It's one of the most dangerous animals in a zoo. Just one kick and your back is broken or your torso is crushed.
Yes, Father.
the spotted deer. So pretty, aren't they? If the male feels he has to, he'll charge you and those short little antlers will pierce you like daggers.
Yes, father.
The Arabian camel. One slobbering bite and you've lost a chunk of flesh.
Yes, father.
The black swans. With their beaks, they'll crack your skull. With their wings, they'll break your arms.
Yes, father.
The smaller birds. They'll cut through your fingers with their beaks as if they were butter.
Yes, father.
The elephants. The most dangerous animal of all. More keepers and visitors are killed by elephants than by any other animal in a zoo. A young elephant will most likely dismember you and trample your body parts flat. That's what happened to one poor lost soul in a European zoo who got into the elephant house through a window. An older, more patient animal will squeeze you against a wall or sit on you. Sounds funny, but think about it.
Yes, father.
There are animals we haven't stopped by. Don't think they're harmless. Life will defend itself no matter how small it is. Every animal is ferocious and dangerous. It may not kill you, but it will certainly injure you. It will scratch you and bite you, and you can look forward to a swollen, pus-filled infection, a high fever, and a 10-day stay in the hospital.
Yes, father.
We came to the guinea pigs, the only other animals besides Mahisha to have been starved at father's orders, having been denied their previous evening's meal. Father unlocked the cage. He brought out a bag of feed from his pocket and emptied it on the floor. You see these guinea pigs?
Yes, father.
The creatures were trembling with weakness as they frantically nibbled their kernels of corn. Well, he leaned down and scooped one up. They're not dangerous. The other guinea pigs scattered instantly. Father laughed. He handed me the squealing guinea pig. He meant to end on a light note. The guinea pig rested in my arms tensely. It was a young one. I went to the cage and carefully lowered it to the floor. It rushed to its mother's side. The only reason these guinea pigs weren't dangerous, didn't draw blood with their teeth and claws, was that they were practically domesticated. Otherwise, to grab a wild guinea pig with your bare hands would be like taking hold of a knife by the blade. The lesson was over. Ravi and I sulked and gave Father the cold shoulder for a week. Mother ignored him too. When I went by the rhinoceros pit, I fancied the rhino's heads were hung low with sadness over the loss of one of their dear companions. But what can you do when you love your father? Life goes on, and you don't touch the tigers. Except that now, for having accused Ravi of an unspecified crime he hadn't committed, I was as good as dead. In years subsequent, when he was in the mood to terrorize me, he would whisper to me,
"Just wait till we're alone. You're the next court."
Chapter 9. Getting animals used to the presence of humans is at the heart of the art and science of zookeeping. The key aim is to diminish an animal's flight distance, which is the minimum distance at which an animal wants to keep a perceived enemy. A flamingo in the wild won't mind you if you stay more than 300 yards away. Cross that limit, and it becomes tense. Get even closer, and you trigger a flight reaction from which the bird will not cease until the 300-yard limit is set again, or until heart and lungs fail. Different animals have different flight distances, and they gauge them in different ways. Cats look. Deer listen. Bears smell. Giraffes will allow you to come to within 30 yards of them if you are in a motor car, but will run if you are 150 yards away on foot. Fiddler crabs scurry when you're 10 yards away. Howler monkeys stir in their branches when you're at 20. African buffaloes react at 75. Our tools for diminishing flight distance are the knowledge we have of an animal, the food and shelter we provide, the protection we afford. When it works, the result is an emotionally stable, stress-free wild animal that not only stays put, but is healthy, lives a very long time, eats without fuss, behaves and socializes in natural ways, and, the best sign, reproduces. I won't say that our zoo compared to the zoos of San Diego or Toronto or Berlin or Singapore, but you can't keep a good zookeeper down. Father was a natural. He made up for a lack of formal training with an intuitive gift and a keen eye. He had a knack for looking at an animal and guessing what was on its mind. He was attentive to his charges, and they, in return, multiplied. Some to excess. Chapter 10. Yet there will always be animals that seek to escape from zoos. Animals that are kept in unsuitable enclosures are the most obvious example. Every animal has particular habitat needs that must be met. If its enclosure is too sunny or too wet or too empty, if its perch is too high or too exposed, if the ground is too sandy, if there are too few branches to make a nest, if the food trough is too low, if there is not enough mud to wallow in, and so many other ifs, then the animal will not be at peace. It is not so much a question of constructing an imitation of conditions in the wild as of getting to the essence of these conditions. Everything in an enclosure must be just right. In other words, within the limits of the animal's capacity to adapt. A plague upon bad zoos with bad enclosures. They bring all zoos into disrepute. Wild animals that are captured when they are fully mature are another example of escape-prone animals. Often, they are too set in their ways to reconstruct their subjective worlds and adapt to a new environment. But even animals that were bred in zoos and have never known the wild, that are perfectly adapted to their enclosures and feel no tension in the presence of humans, will have moments of excitement that push them to seek to escape. All living things contain a measure of madness that moves them in strange, sometimes inexplicable ways. This madness can be saving. It is part and parcel of the ability to adapt. Without it, no species would survive. Whatever the reason for wanting to escape, sane or insane, zoo detractors should realize that animals don't escape to somewhere, but from something. Something within the territory has frightened them. The intrusion of an enemy, the assault of a dominant animal, a startling noise, and set off a flight reaction. The animal flees, or tries to. I was surprised to read at the Toronto Zoo, a very fine zoo I might add, that leopards can jump 18 feet straight up. Our leopard enclosure in Pondicherry had a wall 16 feet high at the back. I surmise that Rosie and Copycat never jumped out, not because of constitutional weakness, but simply because they had no reason to. Animals that escape go from the known into the unknown. And if there is one thing an animal hates above all else, it is the unknown. Escaping animals usually hide in the very first place they find that gives them a sense of security, and they are dangerous only to those who happen to get between them and their reckoned safe spot. Chapter 11. Consider the case of the female black leopard that escaped from the Zurich Zoo in the winter of 1933. She was new to the zoo, and seemed to get along with the male leopard. But various paw injuries hinted at matrimonial strife. Before any decision could be taken about what to do, she squeezed through a break in the roof bars of her cage and vanished in the night. The discovery that a wild carnivore was free in their midst created an uproar among the citizens of Zurich. Traps were set, and hunting dogs were let loose. They only rid the canton of its few half-wild dogs. Not a trace of the leopard was found for 10 weeks. Finally, a casual laborer came upon it under a barn 25 miles away and shot it. Remains of roe deer were found nearby. That a big black tropical cat managed to survive for more than 2 months in a Swiss winter without being seen by anyone, let alone attacking anyone, speaks plainly to the fact that escaped zoo animals are not dangerous absconding criminals, but simply wild creatures seeking to fit in. And this case is just one among many. If you took the city of Tokyo and turned it upside down and shook it, you would be amazed at the animals that would fall out. It would pour more than cats and dogs, I tell you. Boa constrictors, Komodo dragons, crocodiles, piranhas, ostriches, wolves, lynx, wallabies, manatees, porcupines, orangutans, wild boar. That's the sort of rainfall you could expect on your umbrella. And they expected to find. Ha! In the middle of a Mexican tropical jungle, imagine. Ha ha! It's laughable, simply laughable. What were they thinking? Chapter 12. At times he gets agitated. It's nothing I say. I say very little. It's his own story that does it. Memory is an ocean, and he bobs on its surface. I worry that he'll want to stop, but he wants to tell me his story. He goes on. After all these years, Richard Parker still preys on his mind. He's a sweet man. Every time I visit, he prepares a South Indian vegetarian feast. I told him I like spicy food. I don't know why I said such a stupid thing. It's a complete lie. I add dollop of yogurt after dollop of yogurt. Nothing doing. Each time it's the same. My taste buds shrivel up and die. My skin goes beet red, my eyes well up with tears, my head feels like a house on fire, and my digestive tract starts to twist and groan in agony like a boa constrictor that has swallowed a lawnmower. Chapter 13. So you see, if you fall into a lion's pit, the reason the lion will tear you to pieces is not because it's hungry, be assured, zoo animals are amply fed, or because it's bloodthirsty, but because you've invaded its territory. As an aside, that is why a circus trainer must always enter the lion ring first, and in full sight of the lions. In doing so, he establishes that the ring is his territory, not theirs, a notion that he reinforces by shouting, by stomping about, by snapping his whip. The lions are impressed. Their disadvantage weighs heavily on them. Notice how they come in. Mighty predators though they are, kings of beasts, they crawl in with their tails low and they keep to the edges of the ring, which is always round so that they have nowhere to hide. They are in the presence of a strongly dominant male, a super alpha male, and they must submit to his dominance rituals. So they open their jaws wide. They sit up. They jump through paper-covered hoops. They crawl through tubes. They walk backwards. They roll over. He's a queer one, they think dimly. Never seen a top lion like him. But he runs a good pride. The larder's always full and, let's be honest, mates, his antics keep us busy. Napping all the time does get a bit boring. At least we're not riding bicycles like the brown bears or catching flying plates like the chimps. Only the trainer better make sure he always remains super alpha. He will pay dearly if he unwittingly slips to beta. Much hostile and aggressive behavior among animals is the expression of social insecurity. The animal in front of you must know where it stands, whether above you or below you. Social rank is central to how it leads its life. Rank determines whom it can associate with and how, where and when it can eat, where it can rest, where it can drink, and so on. Until it knows its rank for certain, the animal lives a life of unbearable anarchy. It remains nervous, jumpy, dangerous. Luckily for the circus trainer, decisions about social rank among higher animals are not always based on brute force. Heidegger, 1950, says, "When two creatures meet, the one that is able to intimidate its opponent is recognized as socially superior, so that a social decision does not always depend on a fight. An encounter in some circumstances may be enough." Words of a wise animal man. Mr. Heidegger was for many years a zoo director, first of the Basel Zoo, and then of the Zurich Zoo. He was a man well-versed in the ways of animals. It's a question of brain over brawn. The nature of the circus trainer's ascendancy is psychological. Foreign surroundings, the trainer's erect posture, calm demeanor, steady gaze, fearless step forward, strange roar, for example, the snapping of a whip or the blowing of a whistle, these are so many factors that will fill the animal's mind with doubt and fear and make clear to it where it stands, the very thing it wants to know. Satisfied, number two will back down, and number one can turn to the audience and shout, "Let the show go on!" And now, ladies and gentlemen, through hoops of real fire. Chapter 14. It is interesting to note that the lion that is the most amenable to the circus trainer's tricks is the one with the lowest social standing in the pride, the omega animal. It has the most to gain from a close relationship with the super alpha trainer. It is not only a matter of extra treats. A close relationship will also mean protection from the other members of the pride. It is this compliant animal, to the public no different from the others in size and apparent ferocity, that will be the star of the show, while the trainer leaves the beta and gamma lions, more cantankerous subordinates, sitting on their colorful barrels on the edge of the ring. The same is true of other circus animals and is also seen in zoos. Socially inferior animals are the ones that make the most strenuous, resourceful efforts to get to know their keepers. They prove to be the ones most faithful to them, most in need of their company, least likely to challenge them or be difficult. The phenomenon has been observed with big cats, bison, deer, wild sheep, monkeys, and many other animals. It is a fact commonly known in the trade. Chapter 15. His house is a temple. In the entrance hall hangs a framed picture of Ganesha, he of the elephant head. He sits facing out, rosy-colored, pot-bellied, crowned and smiling, three hands holding various objects, the fourth held palm out in blessing and in greeting. He is the Lord Overcomer of obstacles, the God of good luck, the God of wisdom, the patron of learning, simpatico in the highest. He brings a smile to my lips. At his feet is an attentive rat, his vehicle. Because when Lord Ganesha travels, he travels atop a rat. On the wall opposite the picture is a plain wooden cross. In the living room, on a table next to the sofa, there is a small framed picture of the Virgin Mary of Guadeloupe, flowers tumbling from her open mantle. Next to it is a framed photo of the black-robed Kaaba, holiest sanctum of Islam, surrounded by a 10,000-fold swirl of the faithful. On the television set is a brass statue of Shiva as Nataraja, the cosmic lord of the dance, who controls the motions of the universe and the flow of time. He dances on the demon of ignorance,
his four arms held out in choreographic gesture, one foot on the demon's back, the other lifted in the air. When Nataraja brings this foot down, they say time will